Six Music.
BBC Radio Six Music Documentaries.
Welcome, I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we speak to some of music's most influential figures about the pivotal first moments that shaped their lives and their careers, the events and the songs that led them to be where and who they are today. Robbie Robertson's music is woven through American cultural history in a remarkable way, and he's rightly seen as something of a creative godhead in the US and his home country of Canada. In this episode of The First Time, Robertson gives a rare interview and discusses his childhood and the influence of his combined Mohawk and Canadian parentage, his development to become one of the most precociously gifted guitarists around with his band The Hawks at the very break of the 60s. And happily, for someone who's often distanced himself from the past, Robertson also talks about his time as a key member and songwriter with The Band, one of the greatest groups in music history, responsible for the legendary album Songs from Big Pink, and whose authentic folk and country-influenced music shifted the psychedelic flamboyance of the late 60s into a more soulful direction. In fact, you just heard Up on Cripple Creek from 1969 by The Band. Robbie also recalls the band famously backing Bob Dylan on his first ever electric tour, a tour that caused shockwaves throughout music, prompting cries of Judas across Europe. Now a well-respected solo artist, his first solo album in 13 years was released earlier this year. He also chats about his role as a music director with Martin Scorsese, a role he's enjoyed since the 80s, working on Raging Bull, The King of Comedy, Casino, The Departed and Shutter Island. He's also just one of the coolest people I've ever met. I mean, he was in The Band. He also has an incredible passion for music that seems to have grown over the years. I'm very proud to say my guest on The First Time this week is Robbie Robertson.
Up on Cripple Creek.
And my first question to Robbie was, as it always is with people on this show, when was the first time you were aware of music?
I was first really connected to music on the Six Nation Indian Reservation, where my mother was born and raised. And I grew up between Toronto in Canada and the Six Nation Indian Reserve. And on the reservation, it seemed to me that everybody played an instrument, you know, because there wasn't a lot of big shows coming through the res in those days. So everybody had to supply their own entertainment. So it looked to me like everybody either played an instrument, sang, or danced. And as a young kid, I thought, well, I need to get in on this, right? And so as a very, I don't know, probably 8 years old, somewhere 8, 9 years old, I was looking at all these different instruments, and the one that looked the sexiest to me was the guitar. And So I thought, you know, is it okay if I, you know, could start learning that? And some of my relatives started teaching me little things on the guitar.
Like what?
Just some chords here and there, or a simple little melody that I could play enough that would give me, you know, a feeling of, oh, I, you know, maybe I can do this. And as I kept being introduced to that, there was a time that I specifically remembered that not only can I do this, but I'm getting better at this than any of you, you know. So that was a sign that I should continue.
What was that first guitar like? Can you remember it? Did you love that instrument?
I had a couple of first guitars. One of them was like what most young guitar players get from their parents. They send away in the catalog and they get like a guitar and it has a picture of a cowboy on it or something. Now, I was with the Indians, so the picture of the cowboy on there, I was trying to figure out, is that going to float, you know, with everybody? But because the reservation was in the country, people there sang country music. They didn't think about, oh, Indians are Indians and cowboys are cowboys. They liked the music of Hank Williams and Lefty Frizzell, I remember back then specifically. And so it wasn't a problem at all.
I wondered so aimless, life filled with sin, I wouldn't let my dear Savior in. Then Jesus came like a stranger in the night. Praise the Lord, I saw the light.
What was the first record that you owned? Can you remember the first disc that was yours?
I think it was Rip It Up by Little Richard.
Good tune.
Yeah. And it was an amazing shuffle on that. And he recorded those early records in New Orleans, where they had the best musicians back then. And the sound of that record just killed me back then.
Well, it's Saturday night and I just got paid. Fool about my money, don't try to save. My heart say go, go. Have a time, cause it's Saturday night. Now I'm feeling fine, I'm on a rock it up.
In terms of your first musical obsessions, who did you really become totally, totally absorbed by when you were a kid?
I would say that my first real addiction to music came from when I heard Carl Perkins sing Blue Suede Shoes. And I thought, and he plays an electric guitar. He writes the songs, plays the guitar solo, sings them. That's my kind of guy. You know, because I thought you could be more ambitious on the guitar than just strumming. And Elvis, you know, obviously, you know, broke open the door and was making it all happen. But that was already becoming a little bit, and within months, a little bit obvious to me, because everybody was going in that direction. And I've always had this issue: if the crowd's running that way, I want to look in a different direction. That, because that just feels too obvious.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoe. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place, and do anything that you wanna do. But honey, lay off of my shoes, and don't you step on my blue suede shoe. You can do anything but lay off of my blue suede shoe.
What was your very first band like?
My first band was not that good. You know, as you know, you wouldn't be surprised. And I was probably 13, and it was my own band. And all the guys in the band were older than me. And it was a good experience of just learning, you know, just about the direction and the idea of that it was not only your responsibility to sing the song and play the song, but to figure out what other people should be doing too. And it taught me that if nobody does that, you don't improve, you don't go anywhere, and you can't depend on other people to figure that out for you.
So what about would the Hooks be your first kind of professional band, I suppose? As a serious musician?
As a serious professional musician, but I had another band called Robbie and the Robots. I was in another band called Thumper and the Trambones. And then I was in a semi-professional group called Little Caesar and the Consoles. And then this other group, this Robbie and the Robots, was going on after that. And it was at that point that I caught the attention of Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks. And by then I was 15.
That's young, though, isn't it, to be? That's
didn't seem that way to me. I thought, this is all taking way too long. Yeah.
When you started playing with the guys that were kind of go on to become the band, was it quite an immediate, we have something special here? Did you feel that straight from the off?
I felt very strongly about what Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks were when I first experienced their music. I thought that they played faster and more violently than anybody else. And it was really exciting to me as a young boy at that time. And then I wrote a couple of songs that Ronnie Hawkins recorded when I was 15. And that's what really kind of pulled me into it. And then at that time, they were all from Arkansas. But they were playing a lot up in Canada because they made more money and the hours were shorter, you know, just, you know, obvious choice. And then one of the guys in the group from Arkansas wanted to leave and go home and be with his family and everything. And so I was the first Canadian in the group. And then after I was in there, between Ronnie Hawkins and Levon and myself, we started hand-picking the other guys that ultimately would become the Hawks that became the band. But there was other people before them along the way that we went through to get to that. It wasn't all immediate choices. But over the next, I'd say, year and a half or something, we've sorted that out and picked those guys that were all just, their talent was just streaming out of them. And when all of these guys were in the group, we felt like we did have something.
I need someone like you to tell my troubles to. Oh, baby, someone like you.
I need someone like you.
Sweetest kiss I ever knew. That's why I need someone like you. Oh, baby, someone like you.
I need someone like you.
When did you first meet Dylan? Actually, what were your first impressions of him when you met him?
When I first met him, I wasn't sure what I thought, because we were a group looking to do our own thing. We weren't looking. We'd already done that with Ronnie Hawkins. And so this was a bit of a detour, it seemed, to be doing this with him. But we had a reputation at the time, the Hawks, as being a really good band. And so the word was out, and he was trying to find a really good band. And I was trying to figure out whether he knew what that was, meaning he was a folk singer. He was somebody used to playing with just himself on the guitar and the harmonica. And when you have to figure out, you know, so everybody's playing together, whether he knew anything about that. And he didn't. And so this was a struggle in the beginning to get to a place where you thought this music of what he's doing and what we can do is really melding together. It didn't happen immediately. And for a while, it was really, you know, it was up in the air of whether this was a calling for us or not. And it was probably a calling for him, too, to say whether these guys are right for what I want to do. And in the very beginning, everybody was telling him, you got to get rid of these guys. They're ruining your career.
Were those first gigs pretty scary then?
They were scary. And nobody, we hadn't had that experience before of being demonized like that, you know.
Because that's the myth. Did it really, I mean, there's this massive myth around what happened. And the screaming, the shouting, and going electric. What did it really feel like that at the time? Did you really feel persecuted?
Yeah, well, when you play all over North America, all over Australia, all over Europe, and every night, people boo you, and in some cases, throw stuff at you. Eventually, it sinks in that they don't like us. You do get the message. But we were on a mission, and in the beginning, it was like, I don't know if I like, you know, we were all like, we don't know if we like this music. We don't know if this is where we should be. But then it was fascinating. And all of a sudden, it started to strike me a different way. Like, there's something going on here. There's a musical revolution taking place here. And I think that we've got to see this through. I think we've got to see what this experience is. And then finally, the more that I knew about Bob's music and him as a person, as we became really good friends, and it was like we were war buddies going through this together. So it turned out that, you know, that certain things, you know, bring you closer together, and this was one of those things. But we came through it alive. And by the time we got to England, when we were doing this, we were doing it good. We'd listen to those tapes and we'd look at one another and say, that's pretty damn good. I'm sorry. You people are wrong and we're right. That was a very bold statement at the time, and it turned out that the world came around. We didn't change a thing. And that's an extraordinary accomplishment in the history of music.
See, you got your brand new lips and pillbox hair. Yes, sir. See, you got your brand new lips and pillbox hair. Well, you must tell me, baby, how your head feels under something like that.
What can you remember about recording that first band album, music from Big Pink? Because it's a wonderful record. Is it? Was it an easy record to make?
Well, it was an easy record to make because we had done our homework and we had figured out what we wanted to do musically, and it had nothing to do with what we had done with Bob Dylan in the live concerts, nothing to do with what we did as the Hawks, and nothing to do with when we played with Ronnie Hawkins. This was a complete change of mood, and what it really turned out to be was a culmination of all the musicalities from our journeys on the road that we had gathered. We were gathering gospel music and blues and mountain music and R&B and rock and roll. And that record was like putting it all in a big pot, mixing it up and making a new gumbo of music. And when that record came out, people said, what is this? Where did that come from? You know, and I was, what are you talking about? This is what you do. This is what you do when you're really serious about making a musical statement. We had already been together for 7 years when we made that record. We'd been woodshedding and honing our skills, and that was our idea of what this was. This wasn't about getting some cute guys together and get some guitars for Christmas and starting a band, you know. This was serious with us. And so when we made that record, people would comment on it and look at it like there was something extremely mature and timeless about it. And that was because we didn't just, you know, we weren't born yesterday. We really, really went into this, you know, and trying to do something so emotional and, you know, and paying respect to all these musicalities that we had gathered.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half past dead. I just need some place where shook my hand, no was all he said. Take a load off, Fanny. Take a load for free. Take a load off, Fanny.
And you put the load right on. When I saw Carmen and the devil walking side by side, I said, hey, Carmen, come on, let's go downtown. She said, I gotta go, but my friend can stick around.
It seemed like quite a tumultuous band to be in. Lots of strong personalities, lots of gifts, lots of very talented people. Did it become difficult to keep up that level of creativity, to keep up working in that environment? You said that 7 years before you even released that record. That's like a marriage to a bunch of other people,
mm-hmm.
on the road, mm-hmm. in the studio. That's got to be quite taxing.
You know, it didn't feel that way. It didn't feel that way until real success set in.
Okay.
And also, at a certain point, we were growing up. You know, we were really young. I mean, we were acting like we were growing ups, but we were really kids. When we were playing with Bob Dylan, I think I was 21. And then when you grow up, then somebody would get married. And so then you're not in the same huddle as you were together. And then over the period of times, it starts drifting and it starts coming undone to what it originally was. And you can't go back. You have to accept life as it comes at you and in the different directions that you grow. And you do grow in different directions. You know, that's just the way it is. Because the band was not just, this wasn't a guitar player and a singer and some other guys. This was a group. Mm. That's why it was called The Band, because it really was that. Everybody had a very particular part in this movie. One of those cylinders wasn't working, you know, as strong as the others. Everything was out of kilter. And that delicacy would really weigh on you. And so, you know, as time went on and people became, you know, more reckless in their lives, and whether it was from, you know, alcohol or drugs or lifestyle, whatever it was, those things really played into it. And because it was a delicate balance, it would never feel like what we were trying to reach for.
And you put the load right on me.
You're listening to The First Time here on Six Music with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Robbie Robertson.
BBC Radio Six Music.
Was Rag Mama Rag from the band's self-titled second album from 1969, with guitar courtesy of Robbie Robertson, my guest here on The First Time. For many people, the greatest ever concert film made is The Last Waltz, centering on the band's now legendary Thanksgiving Day concert in 1976 at the Winterland Ballroom in San Francisco. This featured the group at the height of their powers and includes guest appearances from Eric Clapton, Neil Young, Neil Diamond, Bob Dylan, Emmylou Harris, Dr. John, Joni Mitchell, Van Morrison, Ringo Starr, Muddy Waters and Ronnie Wood. It was also directed by Martin Scorsese, no less. I asked Robbie Robertson when he first met with the legendary director.
Well, I first met him after he did this movie, Mean Streets. And they had a screening of it that I went to, and I recognized something in that movie that I felt very strongly about his storytelling and about his use of music in that. And it was so powerful to me that I never quite got over it. And then after that, though, he made Taxi Driver, and then he made Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and he was making, the next time I met him, he was in the middle of making a New York, New York. And I had thought of, you know, I thought of Hal Ashby, I thought of all of those guys that were, you know, really becoming amazing at that time, like Francis Coppola. I was going down the list of all of these people, and from, and I was a film buff, so I knew things about them from their movies and from what I'd heard about them and their personal lives too, the way they worked and stuff like that. And when I went through the list, I never got any further than Martin Scorsese. And so then we set up a meeting to talk about this idea of this concert and this film. And I told him about it, and I could see it was just putting him through changes. Like, he was squirming and nervous and uncomfortable. And what it was that he was in the middle of shooting a movie. And when you're in the middle of shooting the movie, you're not allowed to go and shoot another movie.
Okay.
they don't have a sense of humor about that kind of thing. So he was saying, I don't know, all these people, this is all of the stuff that I love. I got to do this. I got to figure this out. This is impossible. I don't know what to do. So it was that kind of thing. And so then over the next period of time, we set about figuring out a technique in the way that we could do this. And that's how we landed on doing it on New Year's in San Francisco, which was the place that the band did their first concert as the band. And that they would be taking off the Thanksgiving weekend, right? And so he could say, oh, yeah, I guess I'll just go out to the country and rest up for the weekend or something. And he actually went off and did this. And when the producers of the movie that he was doing heard about this, they were outraged, but it was too late. We'd already, you know, the concert was done and we shot it and really felt meant to be.
Do you remember watching The Last Waltz for the first time? Do you remember the first screening?
Well, there was a lot of work to do on this movie. So it wasn't like I'd seen it hundreds of times in bits and pieces of scenes and music and where can we do the edit on this and that and all of the things that had to be figured out. But I can remember the first time that we saw it with a real audience, mm-hmm. not a screening of it. I remember the first time I saw some footage of it too, and it was the first time that a music film like this had ever been shot in 35 millimeter.
'Cause it looks beautiful.
And it was breathtaking how beautiful it looked. And Marty was just, his feet weren't even touching the ground. You know what I mean? He was that excited about it. And I thought, wow, isn't that something? It's amazing that nobody has done this before, I thought. And the reason they hadn't done it before is because these cameras, Panavision cameras, and the type that they were using to shoot the film, they can't run for hours like that. And the director of photography on the film, Michael Chapman, said, these cameras are going to melt. They're not meant to run like this, and I do not guarantee that we're going to make it through this, because that concert went on for hours, like 5 hours. The whole evening went on for. So we got through it, and everything, it was like the stars were aligned.
Tracks again in the winter of 65.
What was the first movie score that you composed?
Well,
there was a couple around the same time, wasn't there?
Yeah, but it wasn't about composing for me. It was about understanding the effect that music had on film and film had on music. But I don't score movies in a traditional way. I don't read or write music to begin with. That's a drawback in that kind of thing. So then the next thing is Martin Scorsese asks me to help out with the music on Raging Bull.
Amazing film.
And so I worked on that music. I suggested some songs that would be used within the story in the background, because there was no score for that movie. We were using this Mascagni music that existed and using a particular version of it in a particular way in scenes, and it had that dramatic effect. But just like in the streets where Marty grew up in Little Italy, there's music seeping out of windows and things, opera, there's music in the street. All of this, it was really the heartbeat of the world that we were in at that time. So I suggested music, and then they would go to these clubs. They would go to Webster Hall in the Copacabana back then, and I did the music that was being played in those places that would be suitable, you know, to be realistic for that. And the experience of working on Raging Bull was so powerful that I ended up really becoming drawn to this, but not in a traditional way. I thought there's lots of guys that do that, you know, there's lots of guys that are really good at it. That's not what I'm interested in. I'm interested in breaking the rules and making changes in this and doing things in a completely different way. And that's why every time that I work with Martin Scorsese, it is a different challenge. It's a different movie,
different world,
different music, different way of using the music every time. Like in Shutter Island, and that, it's all modern classical composers that I wanted to use in that. And he thought it was a great idea. That's what we did. And it really worked fabulous in the movie.
And on Shutter Island, there's a track specifically towards the end of the soundtrack of that that means a lot to you. Tell me about that.
Yeah, this is something that I've never done before. And I found this piece of music by a composer by the name of Max Richter from Germany, I believe. And it's called On the Nature of Daylight. And it is a haunting, beautiful piece of music. And I don't know why, but I heard, as I was going through lots of music for this movie, there was a track, a somewhat obscure track of Dinah Washington called This Bitter Earth. And I just, all of a sudden I thought, wouldn't it be great if these two things could melt together into one? And I checked, and they happened to be in the same key. And just at that time, my mother passed away, and her favorite singer was Dinah Washington. So all of a sudden, it's those pieces fit together, and you think, this is something that's meant to be. So I took the Dinah Washington thing, and I cut each of her vocal lines out of it and placed it into this classical piece of music at very particular places until I felt that it sounded like it was seamless and that the music was actually done this way. And there's things happened with that particular piece of music all over the world, from all over the world on YouTube. People are doing ballets to it. I saw skating things to it. And this guy, Gregory Colbert, this amazing a photography artist in his show. He's using it. It was a complete experiment, and I did it, and I played it for Martin Scorsese, and he said, "That just breaks my heart. You know, we gotta use that. We gotta find a place for it."
This bitter earth it bears. Ooh. This bitter earth. And if my life is like the dust, ooh, that hides the glow of a rose. But what good am I? Heaven only knows.
'87 was your first solo record, self-titled, with Daniel Lanois. Gave you a massive hit with Somewhere Down the Crazy River. What took you so long, is the question. Why so long before...
Before doing that?
Yeah.
Because I wasn't thinking about doing that. I thought that I didn't know whether I'd ever wanted to make a record again.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't know. And I was feeling my way along and exploring other things. And so... Before doing that, I worked on Raging Bull, The King of Comedy, and I did score The Color of Money, and which bled over into me doing that first solo album. And there was a lot of other film projects, too, that were coming along. A lot of things that I worked on, and a lot of acting things they were asking me to do. And I came to the conclusion that I wasn't passionate about that. There was too many people telling you what to do. There was too many cooks in the kitchen for me. And I was used to running my own part of the show, right? And because I was producing movies then and acting in movies and doing the music and everything, and I got a little bit spread thin, and I thought, oh my God, this is just exhausting. And there was also a period of time in there too where I wanted to not be the parent that was always away, you know? And so I wanted to stick around the house and just hang out with my wife and kids. And so it was a combination of those things. And then around somewhere around 1985, when I finished working on those films, that I thought, okay, now I want to start writing songs. And I wrote songs, and then we made the record in 1986.
Yeah, I can see it now. The distant red neon shivered in the heat. I was feeling like a stranger in a strange land. You know where people play games with the night. It was too hot to sleep. I followed the sound of a jukebox coming from up the levee. All of a sudden, I could hear somebody whistling from right behind me. I turned around and she said, "Why do you always end up down at Nick's Cafe?" I said, I don't know. The wind just kind of pushed me this way. She said, "Hang the rich." Empty, abandoned 59 Chevy. Laying in the back seat, listening to Little Willie John. Yeah, it's when time stood still. You know, I think I'm gonna go down to Madam X and let her read my mind. She said that voodoo stuff don't.
Had all these firsts, the last thing to do is ask you to choose the final song that will play out. You mentioned Curtis Mayfield. Was it People Get Ready, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the song we were going to finish on. What is it about that track that you love so much?
Curtis Mayfield came with, just like people bring such extraordinary gifts at music in this period. And this was a period, there's a song on my record called When the Night Was Young, that is really highly inspired by Curtis Mayfield. The chord changes, the way I'm playing guitar on it. And I'm telling a story in that song of when People Get Ready, when that song was out. And the way that those worlds collide, and I'm reflecting on that period with that piece of music, the depth in those kind of things, you know, just completely go back to an origin. And the origin for all of that, because that was the sound in the air at that time, was the sound of Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions singing People Get Ready.
Get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers honing. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train to join.
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
This is BBC.
BBC Radio.
Six music. Right now, this is Handpicked.
Hello, this is a shorter version of a weekly new music playlist titled Handpicked by Six Music, one of a big collection of music playlists you can now download and subscribe to in the BBC Sounds app. To find the full version, just search Handpicked and check out some of the other playlists tailored for whatever music you need or mood you're in.